The Australian Medical Students Association acknowledges the traditional owners of the land. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and extend those respects to any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander listeners tuning in.
Hello, hello, and welcome to the Australian Medical Students Association's podcast, AMPUL, where we talk about the things you don't learn in med school. Today, I had the opportunity to chat to David Yerlink, a Canadian pharmacologist, toxicologist, and internal medicine doctor. He is known for researching adverse effects caused by drug interactions, as well as an entertaining but informative presence on Twitter. Notably, David has been publicly critical of regular prescribing of dangerous opioids like tramadol and fentanyl. In this episode, David walks me through the origin of the opioid crisis, including pointing out how Big Pharma pulled the wool over our eyes and provides some very actionable advice on how to approach opioid use in practice. Hope you enjoy. Your name is pronounced David Yerlink, is it not?
Yerlink, yeah, Yerlink. It's a Dutch name, so the J is more like a Y.
Perfect. I was saying Yerlink in my head this whole time until about 2 hours ago when I was listening to another podcast you were on, and it was Yerlink, so I was glad I noticed that.
Yeah, you're not alone, yeah.
So thanks very much for joining me today, David. How are you going?
I'm doing well, thanks. Glad to be here.
That's the way. So just for the interest of everyone else, would you mind telling me what time it is for you right now?
It is 8:13 on the first day of spring, September 21st.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
That is an extremely solid effort, in my opinion. I don't think I'd be capable of recording a podcast at 8 a.m.
I am adequately caffeinated, so we're good to go.
So we start this episode with a set of five rapid-fire questions to get us both a bit warmed up, and to let the audience learn a bit more about you, sort of beyond the credentials. So my first question for you is, and this is stemming off a podcast I recorded a couple of days ago, which was about organ donation. And I asked them, if you were a transplantable organ, which one would you be and why? But for you, I think more appropriate is, if you were a drug, which drug would you be and why?
Ooh, boy, I'd be ketamine. Because of its versatility and, tough one. I could think of all kinds of answers. you're asking what kinds of drugs, the drugs I'm fondest of, you know, ketamine, I'm very fond of buprenorphine, but you know, I'm fond of ceftriaxone too. So I have a hard time picking one drug, but the reason I jumped on ketamine is because I think it's an incredibly versatile drug for pain, because we're going to be talking a lot about the management of pain. Mm-hmm. And I'll unpack maybe a bit more in our discussion later why I think it's a drug that we should be using more. But yeah, it's so incredibly safe, and when it works, boy, it's just a miracle drug. So I'll go with ketamine.
Excellent answer. Miracle drug paralleled with Miracle Man, I guess, if that's what we're getting at. Okay, so my next question is, it's a pretty typical question that sort of we ask, you know, every med student gets asked this, a lot of doctors get asked this. My question is, how did you find your way into medicine?
Oh, it's quite circuitous. I wasn't a terribly good high school student and had always planned to do music for a living. And then I realized at some point in the nick of time that I wasn't quite good enough. And so I applied. So I finished high school in 86. I'm obviously quite a lot older than your listeners. But at the time, I grew up in a rural part of Canada, but at the time, one could go into pharmacy out of high school. And so I applied to and was lucky to get into pharmacy. It was a four-year degree and had no real intentions of going into medicine. But halfway through pharmacy, I think I realized that I really did enjoy the biomedical sciences. And so from third and fourth year pharmacy, I worked quite hard and applied myself and was able to get into medicine, and from there it was pretty easy. But it was not something I had always aspired to do.
Ah, interesting answer. That's not the typical one. I think we often come across the excelled in high school, excelled in uni, excelled in postgrad medicine.
Oh, I almost failed grade 10. Looking back, I'm not kidding. So yeah, no, it was a nice epiphany for me. And in fact, it's funny how the pharmacy link, I didn't even realize pharmacy was a potential career until one of my bandmates our bass player's sister was a pharmacist. I think I had a crush on her. And then we got chatting, and I came to this realization that, hey, pharmacy is a degree that I could, if I applied myself and did okay in the latter years of high school, I might be able to, you know, make a living, because I knew I couldn't do that as a musician. So anyway, that's how medicine for me didn't really enter my mind until probably age 20, 21. And I started medical school at age 22, 30 years ago.
Good amount of time. I guess we can thank the output of this episode to that crush all the way back then.
Yes, that's fair to say.
So my next question is based on a realization I had about an hour ago. So we've been in contact for a few weeks now, and I'd been reading your name in my emails. I'd read it out of my head as David Gerlink. But then an hour before the episode of the recording of this podcast, I was listening to another that you featured on, and I found out it was pronounced Gerlink. So have you had any nicknames based on that, based on your surname, I guess?
Nicknames? There might have been some sort of elementary school teasing of some sort or another, but nothing durable based upon my name. No. So, but it's quite commonly mispronounced. It's a Dutch name. You know, classically, the J's sound like Y's. And in fact, I don't even quite say it properly. My just recently deceased grandmother was the one who could roll it off her tongue in a way that I think would be more fidelitous to its origins. But I know. You wouldn't be the first person, I'll put it that way, to use the harder J. Yeah.
Cool. All right. So my next question is, what is one sentence? What's a one sentence piece of advice you'd give to your former self?
Oh boy, that's a great question. One sentence piece of advice you'd give to your former self.
Yeah, I thought I'd make it difficult for you.
Yeah. Try harder to not let your studies lead you to abandon things you like doing. So, I was for quite a while interested in martial arts and Shotokan karate in particular, and took it for many years and really enjoyed it. But in medical school, I got caught up in studies, but I also used to do a lot of moonlighting as a pharmacist to pay the bills. And so I think that schedule, because the dojo was kind of, it was an 8 a.m. Thing, I ended up attending it less and sort of fell off, so to speak. And I often talk about getting back into it, but that's not the same as having done it for 30 years. So that would be the answer, I think.
I think that is a great answer, particularly given quite a few of the people I've chatted to on this podcast have brought up that, you know, quite often the piece of advice given is to stick to your passions and your hobbies during medical school, because sort of once they drop off, I guess it's a bit more difficult to get them back.
That's very true, yeah.
So my next question is, it is supposed to be quick, rapid-fire questions. I think this one may merit a bit of a longer answer. It's a pretty loaded one. The question is, how has your 2020 experience been?
So my experience has been a combination of revelatory in terms of realizing how much I really loved looking after COVID patients, despite being initially fearful of the risks to myself and my family. It's also been revelatory how much I'm sort of naturally a bit of an introvert. And so I kind of haven't minded so much being cooped up at home, and I'm very lucky to have a wonderful family to spend time with. But I guess I would also say that I've also been, you know, riveted through Twitter and the news about the goings on in the U.S. political system, which is something I've never really, haven't historically followed that closely, but, you know, it's been hard to look away over the last four years or so. And I guess I'm a bit fearful looking forward in the next month or two or three about what might happen, but that's a separate issue. But it hasn't been quite the annus horribilis for me that it has been for some people.
I think it is good as well to see the positives that have come out of COVID. I think actually everybody's had quite a tough time, but I think it's also allowed everyone to really appreciate certain things, like yes. typical Queenslander answer for me, one of the things that I really appreciated once we got out of lockdown was just having the ability to go to the bar and have a beer with a mate. There's something there that you can't get over the phone.
I share that affinity, but I won't be entering a bar for quite a long time. A patio bar, a different story. But
So what is the situation currently over where you are with COVID restrictions and all that?
It depends on which province of Canada you're in. So I'm in Ontario, which is the most populous province. It's the numbers are starting to creep up a lot. So, you know, we went into full lockdown in March and, progressively eased up over in the months that followed. But our counts have really started to go up in the last week or so. That's obviously a reflection in part of people going back to universities and kids going back to school. But also the government has progressively opened things up. And I think a lot of the infections now we're seeing are people in their 20s and 30s. And perhaps 40s, courtesy of just the kinds of get-togethers you're going to expect more of at this time of year. And I foresee in the next couple of weeks, as numbers rise, the government sort of increasing its, stepping back and not allowing indoor dining and indoor bars. And, for some reason, I just find this bizarre. Strip clubs are still open here, which just blows my mind. You can't imagine bars and strip clubs. We should pay them, I think, to be closed for a while. But that's just my two cents.
No, I would definitely agree with that sentiment. There have been a couple of sort of whack policies, I guess, across the world as well. Back in Australia, when we first went into lockdown, I think virtually everything was banned. Apart from you could still go and get your nails done, which was a bit weird for me. That was okay. Yeah. Nothing else was.
I don't understand that either.
All right, so I reckon we'll crack on with the meat of this episode. Given your area of expertise and knowledge and sort of publicity on Twitter, the topics that I wanted to cover today were sort of surrounding pain management, and obviously everything that follows from there. So I think, especially since I'm a little first-year medical student, would you mind starting off with a little overview of the whole opioid epidemic? I'm not sure if that's the correct term, but yeah, let's start there.
Yeah. So you probably will get different answers to several of the questions you ask me if you ask one clinician versus another, but different people will give you different takes on the crisis. I think the crisis has had multiple waves over the past 25 or so years. And so in North America, at least, and I think it's sort of being mirrored in Australia, as I understand it from the data I've seen come out of there. The first wave was sort of a dramatic surge in the prescribing of opioids for acute and chronic pain in particular, beginning in the late 1990s and into the 2000s. About a decade or more into that, the prescribing of opioids was something that was, often, usually, I would say, done by well-intentioned physicians. Mm-hmm. But there were certainly pockets of practice out there where doctors were effectively engaging in criminal activity because these drugs, fetched a high street value and people did become addicted to them. And so there were a lot of pill mills throughout the U.S. and Canada that were just, churning these out to the streets in large numbers. The next wave came in sort of the late 2000s with a surge in the use of heroin and a lot of deaths associated with that. And then the last decade or so, maybe not quite decade, has been associated with a dramatic rise in deaths courtesy of the introduction into North American drug supplies of fentanyl and dozens of analogs of fentanyl, often from China, to meet the societal demand for opioids that now exists. And so this is why people are dying in large numbers now, not so much because of their Percocet or hydromorphone prescriptions, but because they have an opioid use disorder and are using a drug supply that is horribly toxic. They might think they're getting 600 or 800 micrograms of fentanyl in a pill that looks like a Vicodin tablet, but in fact they're getting 5,000 micrograms and dying as a result. So it's had multiple waves, so that's a very quick overview of it. But I guess one other point I would make is that in the last 5, 6, 7 years, there's been a drive I think a good drive or push to get clinicians to prescribe opioids more cautiously, both for acute and chronic pain, and to a certain extent for cancer pain as well. But that drive has sometimes come from, or the push has sometimes come from licensing bodies and governments and doctors, you know, in an effort to perceive themselves as doing something, so to speak, for the crisis writ large. And so that has itself created some problems primarily by taking people on high dose opioids for chronic pain and more or less abandoning them or forcing them to cut back their doses too quickly, which has been another sort of, it's a complex, multifaceted entity, the opioid crisis. but that's one of the facets that we probably should talk about at some point.
Yeah, bloody lot to cover there. I reckon, especially for my sake, I know a lot of the listeners here will be sort of in the upper years of med school, but I haven't actually covered opioids yet in my classes. So could you give a quick sort of tramadol or opioid pharmacology for first year medical students, sort of little thing?
Yeah. So they're kind of a bit different. I mean, tramadol and opioids, obviously related. So opioids refers to any drug that binds to and stimulates opioid receptors, of which there are three main types. But the one we talk about most is the mu opioid receptor. So these drugs, they're broadly divisible into, and not to get too pedantic here, but there are opiates, and there's a distinction. Opioids are any drug. Opioid is a drug that is by its pharmacology a mu opioid agonist. Opiates are sort of that subset of opioids that derive from the opium poppy. So morphine and codeine, for example, and tweaked synthetic versions of those like oxycodone and hydromorphone and heroin, those are all opiates, and they affect their beneficial and harmful effects by binding to stimulating opioid receptors. There are a variety of fully synthetic compounds that look chemically nothing like morphine. Drugs like fentanyl and methadone and tramadol that have as part of their mechanisms of action mu agonism. So that's opioids generally. And I think I'm not sure how much you want to get into sort of the historical stuff here, but I think the doctors have now. It's important to appreciate this. I think that your listeners, like our listeners here, our medical students here and people in early postgraduate training, probably view opioids as the sort of strongest, most effective medications for pain. And it's important to understand that view isn't based on anything. I mean, there's sort of this perception that on the hierarchy, most doctors have a fairly, we don't have a big, toolkit for pain medicines, but most doctors, you'll start with acetaminophen or paracetamol. You will, maybe your next step might be a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug. And then above that, you go to a weak opioid like codeine or tramadol. And above that, a strong opioid like hydromorph or oxycodone or fentanyl. And you might throw in some adjuncts like pregabalin here and there. But the positioning of opioids at the top of this ladder above NSAIDs isn't really based on much at all. And in fact, if you go looking for randomized controlled trials of opioids versus NSAIDs, more often than not, it's the NSAIDs that do better from a safety and effectiveness perspective. But I think one of the reasons why opioids are at the top of this pyramid or this ladder is because they should be resorted to after NSAIDs are tried, or if NSAIDs aren't reasonable, but also because it's sort of been taught that there's no dose threshold, that, if you give somebody 5 or 10 of morphine, 4 or 5 times a day, after a while, because they become tolerant, you can progressively increase the dose. And that's not something we do with NSAIDs or even acetaminophen. I do think, and we can come back to this a bit later, this idea of no dose threshold in opioids is really a very dangerous one. It's true in a sense, but one of the things I hope we get to at some point in the podcast is, the dose makes the poison, right? All drugs, the side effects increase as the dose goes up. And one of the things we aren't very good at, doctors generally, is recognizing the side effects of opioids for what they are. So I'll leave you hanging and we can come back to that one a little later.
I'm sort of frantically typing a number of things to touch on later. That is really interesting though, with the sort of false perception we have with opioids, because sort of from a lay perspective as well, I guess prior to even med school, I had that same belief that it was like, oh yeah, you might get this and that, but if you get opioids from the doc, you know, you've got the good stuff for pain. So you mentioned a bit how there's been like a number of waves with the crisis. You mentioned that at the beginning, it was sort of perhaps overprescription was due to doctors just wanting to do good. Mm-hmm. But as sort of contrary evidence came out, how did the crisis persist?
Well, I think it's worth, if we can, Aidan, speaking a little bit more about its genesis, about the, you know, how it was that we came to prescribe opioids so freely. Because this is a really, really important point. So I was a pharmacist from 1990 to 1995. This is when I was in medical school and internship. And when someone came to the pharmacy with a prescription for morphine, it was almost always because they had cancer. Right? We did not put people on morphine for chronic pain. We did sometimes have people on Tylenol 3. I'm not sure it's called in Australia. It's called Cocodamol in the UK. But you know, codeine and acetaminophen combinations were, you know, there were the occasional patient who was on those drugs long term. But it was really very very uncommon to use opioids for chronic pain. But with the advent of OxyContin, a product produced by Purdue Pharma, in the mid-1990s, it became increasingly more common. And I think the reason why in the early 90s we didn't use opioids for chronic pain was, first of all, our predecessors hadn't really done so. But if you asked them, they would have said, well, they were probably concerned about unmasking addiction, opioid use disorder in a patient who had reasons for it, you know, sociodemographic reasons or genetic factors or what have you. But it wasn't common practice. We relied a lot on non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. And I recall looking after many patients as an intern with GI bleeds and acute kidney injuries. And so we were rightly fearful of NSAIDs. So in the mid-90s in the US and Canada, Purdue Pharma, the manufacturer of OxyContin, got approval to use to market this drug as a treatment for chronic pain. And it launched into a massive marketing campaign to encourage doctors to do just that. And the one of the key elements of this marketing campaign was the doctors didn't need to worry about causing addiction, that addiction would be a very rare consequence of chronic opioid therapy. As it turns out, that the bit of information wasn't based on anything at all. But it was a message that we heard from key opinion leaders and so forth. And I think it was also a message, to be frank, that we wanted to hear. And not to get too philosophical about this, but you know, people go into medical school generally because they want to help people [S2] Yeah. [S1] As part of their life's work. And helping people more often than not, like sometimes it means making a you know, cool diagnosis and, or cutting something out as part of a surgery or what have you. But more often than not, helping people takes the shape of relieving suffering. And the commonest form of suffering doctors see is pain. And we are, you know, pain is aversive. Nobody wants to have pain. We want to help people. And so to suddenly be told, not just by drug companies, but by respected leaders in the field of pain medicine, that we could now use drugs like oxycodone in a way that we historically had not was kind of welcome news. And so, and to be fair, you know, when you started people on, you know, 10 milligrams twice a day of oxycodone, they very often did initially feel quite a lot better and they could often do things they weren't able to do before. So, you know, I think it was a perfect storm of, you know, pain being a common problem that doctors encounter. And us having fairly limited pharmacologic tools to treat pain, the key element, NSAIDs, was one that we were fearful of for good reason, And so to suddenly be told that we now had this other tool at our disposal was we began to use it quite a lot. And not only did we begin to use it, but, we, as I mentioned earlier, we would often find ourselves over the months and years of therapy progressively increasing the dose because the drugs became often less and less effective. It's phenomenon is called tolerance, at least part of the phenomenon is called tolerance. It's probably also hyperalgesia, a paradoxical worsening of the pain caused by opioids. But so we, by the mid-2000s, by 2005 and certainly 2010, it was extremely common to have patients in hospital for whatever problem they had, heart failure, diabetes, you know, whatever. It was very common to see people not just on chronic opioid therapy, but often on very, very high doses of opioids. And that, I think that 15-year period from 95 to 2010, and still in some areas today, you know, that represents a massive failed experiment at the population level on the management of pain using drugs that, while they were approved for chronic pain, they weren't approved on good evidence. I mean, they were approved on short-term studies in very carefully selected patients, studies of 8 and 10 and 12 weeks and 16 weeks duration. There had never been a study looking at opioids for chronic pain compared to an active comparator like an NSAID. So this huge practice change that I'm describing from 95 onwards came about based upon very little evidence of effectiveness and very little evidence of safety. And we're only now in hindsight looking back and saying, holy cow, you know, what did we do? So your listeners will be entering their practices, their clerkships and their registrar years and so forth, viewing opioids in a way that we didn't 25 years ago. And the reason they will view it as they do is because that's just what's come to happen. We've just come to use them all the time, but not based on good evidence, and we've caused quite a lot of harm in the process. Sorry for that very long answer.
No, that was great. Especially as a podcast host, I'm certainly happy for my guests to talk away. It saves me the trouble. That's really insane, looking at how, you know, such a huge, huge part of medical practice was based off nothing when sort of the whole profession is supposed to be based on pure evidence. But like you said, I guess as doctors, you know, you want to help people. And if there's this sort of almost magic drug that will help heaps of your patients, you're going to want to believe that. And I guess perhaps that's why there's a lot of blindness in viewing opioids.
The reasons we were fearful, I mean, we still use NSAIDs all the time. But the thing about NSAIDs is we recognize their side effects. For the most part, I mean, you know, if you ask a strong, you know, third or fourth year medical student about, you know, what are the side effects of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, he or she will talk about the GI toxicities, which can be pretty significant. They'll talk about the renal problems, of which there are several, you know, acute kidney injury, which is, you know, usually a glomerular perfusion hemodynamic issue, but also can, you know, interstitial nephritis can happen, electrolyte disturbances and salt and water retention. I mean, those are pretty important side effects. There are a few other ones, you know, that are a little harder to discern, you know, vascular events, you know, in an 80-year-old on a non-steroidal who has an MI or has a stroke, it's conceivable that the NSAID was part of the causal pathway there, but it's obviously more difficult because that, you know, an 80-year-old has multiple reasons to have those things happen. But so the point I'm making, though, is that, you know, in fact, let's step back to 30,000 feet and ask, you know, what are we trying to accomplish when we start patients on a pain medicine? And if I ask this of a student today, I would very often get the answer, well, I'm trying to relieve their pain, which is a fair answer. Yeah. And it might push them a bit more and say, well, what else are you trying to do? And they'll say, well, I'm trying to improve their quality of life, or maybe, you know, improve their ambulation, or help them get back to work, or help them get out of hospital sooner. These are all perfectly acceptable answers, but they're only part of the answer. Because if you accept the fact that any drug you might give a patient for pain has potential benefits and potential harms, it's easy to see what the real goal is, right? The real goal is to afford the patient more benefits than harms. It's such a a facile observation. It shouldn't even need to be said. The problem with opioids, for both acute and chronic pain, I would say, is that doctors as a whole, we don't understand the harms as well as we'd like to think. If I ask that same medical student, okay, you got an A plus on the side effects of NSAIDs. What about the side effects of opioids? He or she would say, okay, constipation and sedation and maybe some nausea. And, I suppose in excess, there'd be a risk of respiratory depression and overdose. And, addiction might be a potential complication. And I think, those are all true. But there are a whole host of other side effects of opioids that that medicine generally just doesn't think about or doesn't speak about. I would list dependence as probably the most important and I'd say most pernicious of all of them. It's distinct from addiction, but we can come back to it in a moment. But I think it's the side effect that I wish I myself thought about in the early 2000s as I was prescribing these drugs pretty often for patients with pain. But opioid-induced hyperalgesia, which is a very difficult entity to appreciate sometimes, the paradoxical worsening of pain by opioids, falls and fractures and delirium, especially in older people, motor vehicle collisions, sleep disordered breathing. So they can be risk factors for or cause sleep apnea, central and obstructive sleep apnea, testosterone suppression, and low libido, depression itself in some people. Maybe a dose dependent and reversible adverse effect of opioids. Wow. So there's a whole host of side effects that we don't really think about. And if I could single out one, I think it would be this phenomenon of dependence that I'm not sure if you want to talk about that now or not, but the problem is that over time, and especially as the dose goes up, if you imagine in your mind a little, a seesaw, right? And it's sort of slanted down to one side and that's what you want. You want the benefits, the downside to outweigh the harms. But over time, as the dose goes up, it is necessarily the case that the harms will also go up, and including some of these occult harms that we don't even see as harms, like dependence. And so by the time you get somebody, as I often did 10, 15, 20 years ago, have somebody on 200 or 300 or 400 milligrams of morphine a day for chronic pain, because that's all I seem to have at my disposal. It's almost certainly the case that I am harming them more than helping them, even if they and their primary care physician don't see it that way.
So how do you deal with dependence when you see it?
I think it's first important to make sure everyone is talking the same language here, because you'll see dependence and addiction conflated very often, and terms like dependency being thrown about. I think it's useful to just deconstruct what it means. The phenomenon of dependence to me is a pharmacological construct, and it is simply it is the phenomenon that occurs with regular exposure to drugs like opioids and benzodiazepines and SSRIs and a variety of other drugs. That it reflects the neural adaptations to these centrally acting drugs, and critically, it manifests as withdrawal symptoms when the drug is taken away or the dose is lowered too quickly. Okay, so you may have seen patients, or you will see in your training and in your practice, people with alcohol withdrawal. These are people whose neural circuitry has become accustomed to the presence of an agonist, ethanol, and when it's taken away, they get horribly sick. The same thing happens with benzodiazepines and baclofen and, a whole host of other drugs. The withdrawal syndrome varies from drug to drug. So alcohol withdrawal has a pretty typical, phenotype. SSRIs, these are drugs that are used by, millions of people around the world, have a well-defined withdrawal syndrome. It's not nearly as dramatic as benzo or alcohol withdrawal. But they are indirect agonists in the central nervous system, and they've got withdrawal associated with them. So opioid dependence, first of all, it can happen within a couple of days. People will develop, their neural circuitry will become acclimatized, expecting the presence of opioids after just a couple of days of use, but it will intensify as time goes on and as the dose goes up, right? So someone who has taken opioids, let's say postoperatively, for 5 days after major surgery and then suddenly stops, could develop features of opioid withdrawal, like irritability and abdominal cramping and maybe a flare of the underlying pain that they'll perceive as the primary disease process. But in fact, withdrawal hyperalgesia is a well-recognized phenomenon. They might have trouble sleeping. Like it might be, you know, it really depends on the person. But and I've been impressed how the phenotype of opioid withdrawal really varies from person to person. Some people, you know, are doubled over with abdominal pain and diarrhea, and they've got goosebumps everywhere, and they're yawning and sweating, and it looks like the classic kind of heroin withdrawal you might get taught about in medical school. Other people have primarily just crippling insomnia and an inability to function. Other people get really, you know, irritable and emotional and depressed, and some people get all those things. But put yourself and just imagine for a minute that, okay, you're my patient and you've come to me with back pain, we'll say, and I'm scared to use NSAIDs because you've got a history of kidney or GI problems. I put you on opioids. And after maybe a month, you come back to me and say, you know, it was helping, but it seems to be a little less effective now than it was a month ago. And we go up a little bit on the dose. And that same thing happens 3 or 6 months later. And so a year later, you are now taking, just for argument's sake, you're taking oxycodone 40 milligrams twice a day. You're taking 80 milligrams of oxy a day, which is about 120 or so of morphine. And then you suddenly you go away for a weekend and you forget your pills. And you're going to go into opioid withdrawal. And you are going to be miserable. You are going to be suffering to a profound degree. And when you take your pills again, that suffering is going to go away. And you are very reasonably going to view yourself as needing these drugs to continue to function. Mm. And you're going to view these drugs as helpful to you. But what in fact has happened, first of all, we've escalated the dose because the drugs failed in the first place. I mean, we don't think about that often enough. We don't view this need to escalate the dose as a barometer of therapeutic failure. But you and maybe the prescribing doctor, if it wasn't me, would say, well, here's a patient who really needs their opioids. And they do. They mustn't have them taken away. But let's not pretend that we are helping the patient more than harming them. What has happened in that scenario? And to make it even more concrete, let's imagine that you've escalated to 400 milligrams of morphine a day over a period of a couple of years. You're now on a 100 microgram fentanyl patch and you're a chronic pain patient and you're not addicted. You're not smoking your patch. You're not double doctoring. You're just doing what I told you to do and using this med that we've progressively escalated to over time. You are undeniably severely dependent, meaning you will develop withdrawal when the drug is taken away. And that withdrawal might cause you to take your life. I mean, it really is horrible. But I realize I've gone on for a while about this, but it really can't be overstated the importance of viewing that dependence as an iatrogenic harm. It's a side effect of the drug. The reason the patient needs the medicine at that high a dose is because they have been on it. And the avoidance or keeping withdrawal symptoms at bay or forestalling of withdrawal symptoms looks like benefit to the patient, but it's not. We are causing the patient to need these drugs to avoid withdrawal that is itself a consequence of having been on the drugs. And so it's very easy for that, back to that seesaw I mentioned a moment ago, it's very easy for both the doctor and the patient to find themselves in this position where the drugs were started with the best of intentions. But over time, as the dose has gone up, you know, we're now causing more harm than benefit, even though it looks for all the world like we're helping the patient and they must have the medication. So I apologize for rambling there, but it really is, it's a highlight. I think it's why I think dependence is such a pernicious side effect, because it comes to manifest as benefit, or the avoidance of withdrawal comes to manifest as benefit. This doesn't happen with NSAIDs, right? You don't see people on 10,000 milligrams a day of ibuprofen screaming bloody murder when they stop taking it. it just, first of all, we don't escalate to those doses because we are fearful of the side effects, because side effects are dose dependent. We do it with opioids because we don't have a full register of the side effect. And chief among them is dependence there. So I think the dependence of withdrawal and you know, not to mention all the other side effects that I've kind of rambled about, I think is probably the side effect of opioids that I think that medical students and physicians need to be most fearful of.
That is just incredible, the comparison of, oh yeah, happy to up your dose of opioids, but we're not going to give you 10,000 milligrams of ibuprofen. That's just something that I guess me being, I'm 21, so I've sort of seen opioids as they have been in the past 10 years sort of thing. Yeah, it's crazy to think that our just mindset has changed with opioids to the extent where all of this bad is happening. So I guess the follow-up question there is, like, as future medical practitioners, what should we be doing now and in the future to avoid all the harm done by these opioids?
That's a deep question. So I think the first point is that these are valuable drugs in the right patient, right? But I think, first of all, we shouldn't be disavowing their use. We should just be a little more thoughtful about how we use them. We should stop seeing them as somehow superior to NSAIDs. Of course, if you've got a patient with severe pain who's had a GI bleed last week and has a creatinine clearance of 30 mils a minute, you're not going to want to put that patient on an NSAID. That's just common sense. But the idea that because somebody is 70 years old, they shouldn't receive an NSAID and they should receive an opioid, that's just crazy. I mean, that is a viewpoint held by many good doctors, that somehow we need to skip over NSAIDs because they're just too risky. And again, it goes back to our lack of a really solid appreciation of the myriad side effects of opioids. So I would say, you know, how I would view using, I think with opioids, we should really use them as a last resort, meaning after you've really given consideration to whether it's paracetamol or a non-steroidal or in hospitalized patients, we've got other tricks we can use. You know, intravenous ketamine, as I alluded to at your opening, lidocaine, there are other things that we can use that might not work. They might not help the patient, but because they're relatively safe at the doses we're going to involve, we've stacked our individual patient-level experiment in pain relief, where the goal was to help more than harm. When you start that experiment with a drug that is inherently less harmful, like 0.1 or 0.2 mgs per kilogram of ketamine, like it's an easy decision to try something like that, right? You don't know, by the way. I think it really is helpful to use that experiment paradigm. When you're starting a patient on a new medicine for pain, you are in a very real way conducting an experiment. And we know what the goal is, right? It's not just pain relief. It's not just ambulation. It's to help more than harm. You don't know the result of the experiment until you've tried it. And that's why I think the case can be made for using things that might seem a little unorthodox, like ketamine in hospital, or dextromethorphan, weirdly enough, or intravenous lidocaine, or things that themselves are really, frankly, pretty safe, stacks that experiment in your patient's favor. But when you do start a patient on opioids, I think it's important. It's like flying a plane. Like you wouldn't fly a plane if all you knew how to do is take off, right? You need to know how to land. And so I think we should, when we start people on opioids, we should make sure that they have a full appreciation for the side effects, and specifically, especially if we're intending to continue these drugs for weeks or months, or whether we might, for a chronic process, continue them for that long, especially the importance of dependence and withdrawal. If it's for short-term pain, you know, we might want to be a little less cavalier about the amounts. Like, it's nothing. I still see all the time people with a short-term painful problem, like whether it's dental work or an ankle sprain, being given first-line opioids and giving 30 tablets. Like, that's just crazy. It's very easy. In fact, let's back up a little bit. If you're using opioids to treat pain, short-term pain, I think it's really important that the patient and the doctor understand that what you don't want, whether it's post-operative pain or injury pain, you don't want this 2 or 3 or 5 day course of therapy to become a 6 month course of therapy. I think the other side effect of opioids isn't really a side effect, it's a phenomenon. It's when short-term use becomes new persistent use. This happens a lot. After surgical procedures, for your listeners who go into surgery, I mean, this might be the commonest post-operative complication. You have somebody who has, you know, a rotator cuff repair or an appendectomy, and they go home with, you know, you're a little liberal with the prescribing, and they've got not 4 or 5 days, but they've got 2 weeks of therapy. Well, after 2 weeks of regular usage, dependence is pretty damn well entrenched, and that person is going to become unwell when they stop the drugs or when they try and cut back. They'll feel normal again when they resume them, and it's very easy for people to end up, you know, taking a drug for months when it was only intended to be taken for a couple of weeks. So you know, use them when you have to. You know, use opioid sparing techniques to the extent that you can. Keep the dose and the duration to a minimum, and you know, avoid at all costs, avoid progressive dose escalation, especially in your chronic pain patients. It's you know, when you feel the need to increase the dose, especially above 50 milligrams of morphine per day or equivalent, and certainly above 90 or 100, we need to start viewing that as therapeutic failure, right? I mean, that's what it is. It's not only therapeutic failure, it's therapeutic failure that's accompanied by dependence that means you can't just stop these things. Anyway, that's my first and rather rambling thoughts on your question.
No, that's great. I am very appreciative of your rambling thoughts. I think that ramble in particular has a lot of actionable sort of advice. I think the big one for me to implement would just be that change in perspective. And like you said, viewing, you know, upping a dose, not as sort of change in treatment, but rather a failure treatment. Now, we are pretty close to time. Was there anything you wanted to add on to the end of that?
I guess I would highlight the importance. I don't know how many patients in Australia are chronic pain patients are on high doses of opioids, but I think it's important just to reiterate that the sudden abandonment of chronic pain patients and, you know, and cutting their doses back too quickly is a very dangerous thing to do because opioid withdrawal is real misery. And some people, I think, will experience suicidality. I think it's fair to say that some people have taken their own lives because of overzealous cutting back of opioid doses. I think it's important to, there are three groups of patients out there, right? There are people who aren't yet on opioids. And in those people, you want to start opioids very, very cautiously and minimize the dose and duration. There are people who are already on opioids. And in those people, especially on those on higher doses, having a discussion about the potential merits of a very, very gradual, over months, or maybe even longer, taper, very gradual taper is a sensible thing. We haven't talked much about people with opioid addiction, people who are at risk, the highest risk of dying because of a poison drug supply. That's the third group of people who are suffering with opioid use disorder. And those people, you know, they need a whole host of measures. It's probably beyond the scope of this podcast, but you know, we need to view these people as having a health problem, not as being bad people or having made bad judgments or bad, you know, bad decisions. They're, you know, we mustn't view buprenorphine and methadone, which is, you know, opioid agonists. We mustn't view those drugs as replacing one addiction with another. Like these drugs, for people who are injecting fentanyl or, you know, heroin or whatever they're using, who can get on and stay on buprenorphine or methadone, these can be life-saving drugs, you know, because they help people avoid withdrawal and help them, you know, not revert to their patterns of more dangerous use. There's obviously more to treating addiction than just that, but I would view there as sort of three populations of patients out there, and I think that's also a sort of a helpful paradigm.
That's a great way to look at it, and I think the comment I have to get myself is that I think, David, you might be one of my easiest guests I've ever had on the podcast to interview.
Just because I ramble at ad nauseum and don't force you to have to, you know, keep it going, or what? I'm happy to hear that. Yeah.
Okay. I'm just sat here relaxing. It's as if I'm listening to the podcast myself. So it's been great. And I've definitely learned a lot. Thank you for taking the time sitting down with me and offering a lot of these valuable insights. I think I definitely will be attempting to convince you to get back on the podcast with me. So I think there are quite a few topics that I think you'd be happy to rant about that I'd be keen to get on the podcast as well.
Happy to. We could do an entire one on tramadol if you want one day.
Thank you for that, David.
Good talking to you.
Thanks very much for tuning into AMPS's AMPure podcast, where we discuss the things you don't talk about in med school. If you have any feedback for the podcast or ideas of topics or guests you'd like to see in the future, I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me by email on podcast@amsa.org.au. The views, information, or opinions expressed during the AMSA AMPure series do not necessarily represent those of the Australian Medical Student Association.